How are we going to get in there without them seeing us? You still have a few grenades, don't you? Asked Vika.
Markov stared at her. He looked like the kind of man who had been punched in the face many times, his nose flat as a boxer's, half his teeth missing from the lower row. Finally, he shook his head, strapped his rifle to the hilt of a broken branch, and peered out at the approaching column.
You're a real cunt louse, you know that? Take off your whites, she replied. You look like a ski soldier. They'll notice you.
Markov quickly unbuttoned his coveralls, sat in the snow, and pulled them over his boots. Below his whites, he wore a quilted canvas hunting vest, several layers of woolen sweaters, and a pair of paint-splattered workman's pants. He pulled a stick grenade from a canvas pouch, unwrapped a cigarette-sized fuse, and inserted it into the head of the grenade.
We'll have to time it just right, he said.
We huddled around the broad larch trunk, crouched and still, holding our breath as the first German soldiers passed by less than 20 meters away. Nobody had bothered consulting with me, which made sense, because I hadn't opened my mouth to offer any suggestions. I hadn't said a word since running out the door of the trapper's cabin, and now it was too late. I didn't like either of the options. A final shootout might have been fine for a hardened guerrilla like Markov, but I wasn't ready for a suicide mission. Posing as a prisoner seemed a bizarre miscalculation. How long did prisoners survive these days? If anybody had asked me, I would have urged either another run, though I wasn't sure if I could run much farther, or to try climbing the tree and waiting while the Germans passed beneath us. Hiding in the branches seemed like a better and better idea, as the front end of the Gewehrjäger company passed by without spotting us. When the first ranks of Russian prisoners trudged past our tree, Vika nodded at Markov. He took a deep breath, walked toward the edge of the larch's shadow, and hurled the grenade as far as he could. From my vantage point, I couldn't tell if any of the Germans noticed the grenade flying overhead. I didn't hear any shouted warnings. The grenade landed with a muffled th in the snow 30 meters away. For several seconds, I was convinced it must have been a dud, until it exploded with enough force that snow showered down on us from the shaken larch branches. Everyone marching with the company, mountain rangers and prisoners alike, crouched in momentary panic. Looking to the left, where a great geyser of snow had shot into the air. We slipped out of the tree's shadow and walked unseen toward the ragged throng of Russians as the German officers began shouting orders, peering into the far woods with their field glasses, looking for snipers in the trees. We were so close to our captive countrymen, 15 meters away, 14, 13, stepping softly, resisting the impulse to sprint the last short span. The Germans thought they saw movement in the distant bushes. There was a clamor of cries and directives, fingers pointing, soldiers dropping to their bellies, ready to fire from the prone position. By the time they realized there were no enemies to the left, we had infiltrated from the right. A few of the prisoners noticed us joining in with them. They gave no sign of camaraderie or welcome. They didn't seem surprised that four newcomers had joined their ranks. The captives, soldiers and civilians both, were so defeated they probably thought it was natural that Russians would emerge from the woods and secretly surrender to the enemy. All of the prisoners were male, from young boys with missing teeth and frozen strands of snot clinging to their upper lips, to old men with crooked backs and white stubble dusting their jaws. Vika had pulled her rabbit fur cap even lower. In her formless coveralls, she looked enough like an adolescent boy that nobody glanced at her twice. At least two of the Red Army men wore no boots, only their torn wool socks to keep their feet warm. The Germans considered a pair of Soviet-issue felt-lined leather boots a great prize, far warmer and more durable than their own footwear. The soldiers' wool socks must have been soaked through with melted snow. When the temperature dropped and the socks froze, the two of them would have to walk with blocks of ice on their feet. I wondered how much farther they could go, how many kilometers, the numbness spreading from their toes to their calves to their knees. Their eyes were as dull and miserable as the eyes of the draft horses that dragged sledges through the snowy streets of Peter before the food ran out and the horses were slaughtered for their meat. The Germans chattered in their own tongue. None of them seemed badly wounded by the fragmentation, The one young trooper with a thin red gash across his cheek had pulled off his glove so he could dab at the blood with his thumb and show it to his comrades, pleased with his first war wound.
"They think it was a landmine,"
Kolya whispered. He squinted as he listened to the officer's commands.
"They must be Tyrolean. The accents are tricky. Yes, they're saying it was a landmine."
The orders from the officers trickled down to the troopers, who turned back to the meekly waiting prisoners and signaled with their rifles for the march to continue.
"Wait!"
shouted one of the Russians, a thick-lipped civilian in his 40s, wearing a quilted-down cap, the ear flaps tied under his chin. "This man is a partisan!" He pointed at Markov. Everyone else on the hillside had gone silent.
"He came to my house a month ago, stole all my potatoes, every bit of food in the place, said they needed it for the war. You hear? He's a partisan. He has killed many Germans."
Markov stared at the civilian, his head cocked to one side like a fighting dog.
"Shut your mouth,"
he said, keeping his voice low, his face bright red with anger.
"You don't tell me what to do anymore. You don't tell me what to do."
A lieutenant stopped over, trailed by three troopers, shoving through the crowd of prisoners that had circled around Markov and his accuser.
"What is this?" he bellowed.
He was clearly the translator for the company, speaking Russian with a Ukrainian accent. He looked like a fat man who had recently lost all the fat, his broad cheeks deflated, the heavy skin hanging slack across the bones of his face. The accuser stood there with his finger pointing, an overgrown child with his ear flaps and his trembling lips, addressing the lieutenant, but never looking away from Markov.
"He is a murderer, this man. He has murdered your people."
Kolya opened his mouth to speak out in Markov's defense, but Vika jabbed him in the belly with a sharp elbow, and Kolya kept silent. I could see his hand digging into his overcoat pocket, readying the Tokarev in case it was needed. Markov shook his head, a strange, ugly smile splitting his lips.
"I shit on your mother. You don't look so brave now. You don't look so hard. Sure, you're the tough man when you're stealing potatoes from common people. But now what are you? Huh? What are you?"
Markov snarled and snatched a small pistol from the pocket of his hunting vest. Burly as he was, he drew with the speed of an American gunslinger, raising the muzzle as his accuser stumbled backward and the prisoners gathered around dove out of the way. The Germans were even faster. Before Markov could pull the trigger, a burst of automatic fire from the troopers' MP-40s punched a cluster of little holes through the front of his vest. He stumbled, frowning, as if he had forgotten an important name, and toppled backward, landing in the soft snow, wisps of down floating up from the perforated quilting of his vest. The accuser stared down at Markov's body. He must have known what his denunciation would lead to, but now that the act was done, he seemed stunned by the outcome. The lieutenant considered him briefly, trying to decide whether to reward or punish the man. In the end, he snatched up Markov's pistol for a souvenir and walked away, leaving the whole mess behind. His young troopers followed behind him, glancing briefly at Markov's body, wondering, perhaps, which one of them had fired the shot that actually killed him. Soon the company was marching again. A change had been made, however. Six Russians now walked in the front, 10 meters ahead of the closest Germans, serving as human minesweepers. Each step was a harrowing experience for them, waiting for the snapped tripwire, the sprung spring. It must have been tempting to run, but they wouldn't have gotten 3 steps before the troopers gunned them down. Nobody walked near Markov's accuser. He was a man infected, a carrier of plague. He talked quietly to himself, a long and unheard argument, his eyes flashing left and right as he waited for reprisal. I was a dozen men behind him, slogging through the slush between Vika and Kolya. If any of the prisoners spoke loudly enough for the Germans to hear, one of the troopers would snap,
"Halt's Maul!"
Nobody needed a translator to understand the sentiment, and the Russian in question would quickly shut his mouth, lower his head, and walk a little faster. Still, it was possible to carry on a conversation if you kept your voice very low and one eye on the guards.
"I'm sorry about your friend,"
I murmured to Vika. She kept walking without answering or acknowledging that she had heard me. I thought I might have offended her.
"He seemed like a good man,"
I added. Both sentences were utterly banal, the kind of lazy sentiments you might use at the funeral of a distant relative you never really liked. I couldn't blame her for ignoring me.
He wasn't, she said at last. But I liked him anyway.
That traitor ought to be dangling from a tree, whispered Kolya, dipping his head so his voice wouldn't carry. He glared at the back of the betrayer's head.
I could break his neck with my bare hands. I know how to do it.
Leave it alone, said Vika. He doesn't matter. He mattered to Markov, I said.
Vika glanced up at me and smiled. It wasn't the old carnivorous smile I had seen before. She seemed surprised by my comment, as if she had just heard a mongoloid whistle Fuhr Lys without missing a note. Yes, it mattered to Markov. You're a strange one.
Why? He's a twisty little devil,
said Kolya, giving me an affectionate punch in the kidney.
But he plays a nice game of chess.
Why am I a strange one? Markov's not important, she said. I'm not important. You're not important. Winning the war, that's the only important thing.
No, I said. I disagree. Markov was important. So am I and so are you. That's why we have to win.
Kolya raised his eyebrows, impressed that I was standing up to the little fanatic.
I'm especially important, he announced. I'm writing the great novel of the 20th century.
You two are half in love, she said. Do you know that? The grim procession of weary men had bogged down in front of us. The foot traffic stalled, confused prisoners trying to figure out why we weren't moving anymore. One of the bootless Russian soldiers had stopped walking. Other men from his captured unit begged him to move, pleading and cursing. He shook his head, never saying a word, his feet rooted in the snow. A friend tried to shove him forward, but it was useless. He had chosen his spot. When the troopers rushed over, waving their submachine guns and hollering in their own language, the Red Army men reluctantly backed away from their doomed comrade. He smiled at the Germans and raised one hand in a mock Nazi salute. I looked away, just in time. Chapter 20. An hour before sunset, the company halted beside a forbidding red brick schoolhouse, one of the people's projects built during the second five-year plan, the lead glass windows narrow as medieval embrasures. 2-foot-high bronze letters above the front door spelled out Lenin's famous line, "Give us the child for 8 years, and it will be a Bolshevik forever." One of the Russophone invaders had scrawled a rejoinder, in white paint that had dripped before the words had dried. Give us your children for 8 seconds, and there will be no more Bolsheviks. The Wehrmacht had seized the schoolhouse for use as a command center. 6 Kubelwagens were parked near the entryway, and a bareheaded trooper, his blonde hair as short and yellow as a newborn chick's, refueled one of them with a green steel jerry can. He watched with no apparent interest as the company approached with its convoy of prisoners. Officers gave orders, ranks broke, most of the Germans headed inside, already shrugging out of their heavy packs, gabbing with each other, loud and happy, ready for the showers, if the water was running, and a hot meal. The remainder of the Gebersjäger, a platoon of 40 soldiers, irritated that they were still on duty, surly now with hunger and fatigue after a long day hiking through the endless Russian forest, prodded us along to the side of the building. A German officer waited for us there, reclining in a folding chair, reading a newspaper while he smoked. He glanced up with an idle smile when we walked into view, happy to see us, as if we were friends he had invited over for supper. Setting aside his newspaper, he finally stood, nodding, inspecting our faces, the state of our clothing, the quality of our boots. He wore a gray Waffen-SS uniform with green cuffs on the sleeve, his gray overcoat hanging on the back of the folding chair. Vida, walking beside me, murmured,
Einsatzkommando.
When we had been formed into rough lines, the Einsatzkommando dropped his cigarette into the snow and nodded at the Gebersjäger, a slack-skinned translator. They spoke together in confident Russian, as if showing off for their eavesdropping captives. How many? 92. Yes? And 2 who could not join us. Very good. The Einsatzkommando faced us, gazing from man to man, looking us in the eyes. He was a handsome man, his black field cap tilted back from his sunburned forehead, his delicate mustache giving him the air of a jazz singer. "Don't be afraid," he told us. "I know you've been reading the propaganda. The communists want you to think we're barbarians, here to destroy you. But I'm looking at your faces, and I see good, honest workmen and farmers. Is there even a single Bolshevik among you?" No one raised his hand. The German smiled.
"I didn't think so."
"You're smarter than that. You understand that Bolshevism is simply the most radical expression of the eternal Jewish quest for world domination." He looked over the blank faces of the Russian men arrayed before him and gave a good-humored shrug. "But we don't need the fancy talk. You understand the truth in your bones, and that is what matters. There is no reason for conflict between our peoples. Both of us have a common enemy." He signaled to one of the troopers, who picked up a stack of newspapers from a wood pallet beside the folding chair, and divided them out to five of his fellow mountain rangers. They walked down the rows of prisoners, handing one newspaper to each Russian. My copy was Komsomol's Truth. Vika and Kolya had Red Star. "I understand this is a difficult concept to grasp after so many years of propaganda, but believe this for the truth. The German victory will be a victory for the Russian people. If you don't understand this now, you will understand it soon, and your children will grow up knowing it." The sinking sun made giants of our shadows. The Einsatz officer enjoyed the sound of his own words and the impression he made upon us. His Russian was technically perfect, though he made no attempt to hide his accent. I wondered where he had learned the language, if he'd been born in one of the Deutschvolk colonies of Melitopol or Bessarabia. He looked up at an ellipsis of three little clouds far above us in the silvering sky. "I do love this country. Beautiful land." He lowered his head and gave another apologetic shrug. "All this talk, you are thinking, but we are still fighting a war, aren't we? The truth is, my friends, we need you. Each of you will serve the cause. In your hands you hold copies of your illustrious regime's printed lies. You know how honest these papers are. They told you this war would never happen, and here we are. They told you the Germans would be expelled by August. But tell me," and here he gave a stage shiver,
"does it feel like August to you?
But never mind that, never mind. Each of you will read aloud one paragraph. Those we judge literate will come with us to Viborg, where I can promise you 3 meals a day while you translate documents for the provisional government, working in a heated building. Those who fail, well, the work will be a little rougher. I have never been to the steel mills in Estonia, but I hear they can be dangerous places. Still, we'll give you better grub than whatever slop the Red Army was handing out, and I will not even try to guess what you civilians have been eating these past few months." Some of the older peasants groaned and shook their heads, making eye contact with one another, exchanging shrugs. The Einsatz Kommando nodded to the Gebersjäger translator, and within seconds, the two Germans began testing the prisoners. They needed to only hear a few sentences to judge the Russians' literacy. I looked at my copy of Pravda. Atop the lead article was a bold-faced exhortation from Stalin himself. "Compatriots, comrades, eternal glory to the heroes who have given their lives for freedom and the happiness of our nation." The old peasants shrugged and handed their copies back to the Germans without looking at the text. Many of the younger men from the collectives struggled to form a few words. These prisoners took the test seriously, frowning as they tried to decipher the letters. The Germans laughed kindly at the mistakes, slapping the illiterates on their shoulders, joking with them. "You never bothered with the books, did you? Too busy chasing the girls, huh?" Soon the prisoners relaxed and shouted at their friends on the other end of the line. They laughed along with their captors when they stuttered out the words. A few made up their own articles, pretending to read while inventing accounts of battles outside Moscow or the bombing of Pearl Harbor, doing a passable job of imitating the reporting style they'd heard on the radio. The Germans seemed to enjoy the ruse. Both sides knew nobody was fooled. The Germans asked each failure to step to the left. The first few men to stand there looked embarrassed about their public humiliation, but they cheered up as the ranks of the unlettered grew.
"Ah, Sasha, you too. I thought you were the bright one.
Look at him squirming over there in front of the officer. Come on, come on, it's the steel mills with us. What, you thought you might get the office job? What a joker. Look at him, still at it. Old Edik, you think you can walk all the way to Estonia? Huh? Come on, cheer up, we'll give you a hand." The men who could read wanted to impress the Germans. They recited the lines like actors delivering monologues. Many of them kept going after they were told to stop, giving little flourishes to the bigger words, demonstrating their ease with the vocabulary. They stepped to the right, proud and beaming, nodding to their educated fellows, pleased with how the day had gone. Viborg wasn't so far, and working in a heated building with 3 meals a day was a better deal than sitting in a trench all night, waiting for the mortars to drop. Kolya rolled his eyes, watching the literates congratulate each other.
"Look at them," he muttered under his breath. "They want a prize because they can read the newspaper. And look how condescending those fritzes are. Maybe I'll give them the first chapter of Yevgeny Onyegin. Think that would impress them? 60 stanzas, rat-a-tat-tat. They think they're the only culture in Europe? They really want to match Goethe and Heine against Pushkin and Tolstoy? I'll give them music. It's closer than they think, but I'll give them music. And philosophy. But literature? No, I think not."
The black-capped Einsatzkommando was only 2 men down the line from Kolya, who stood to my left. I felt a gloved hand squeezing my right hand, and I turned to see Vika, her pale face tilted up toward mine, her fierce eyes unblinking even through the slanting rays of sunlight. She had taken my hand to alert me of something, but she did not let go as quickly as she might have, or at least this is what I told myself. I could make her love me. Why not? So what if her general attitude toward me was bored disgust?
"You don't read,"
she informed me with that practiced whisper, too quiet for anyone else to hear. She kept watching me to make sure I understood. For once in my life, I didn't need an explanation. The Einsatzkommando, as patient and benevolent as a professor, stood listening to the Red Army man beside Kolya. "Soon Europe will fly the great flag of freedom for the nations. Good. And peace between the nations. Good, good. To the right." I elbowed Kolya's arm. He glanced at me, impatient, ready to show his patronizing fascist the real face of Russian letters. I shook my head once. The Einsatzkommando walked up to him. There was no chance to say anything. All I could do was stare into Kolya's eyes and hope he understood. "And here's a fine-looking man of the steppes. Have a bit of the Don Cossack in you?" Kolya stood straight. He was taller than the Einsatz man, and for a few seconds he looked down at the German without opening his mouth. "I wouldn't know. Born and bred in Peter. Beautiful city. Seems a shame calling it Leningrad. Ugly name, isn't it? I mean, aside from all the politics. Just seems wrong to me. St. Petersburg. That's a name that resonates. All the history. I've been there, you know. Moscow, too. Expect I'll visit them again before too long. Now, show me what you can do." Kolya held up the newspaper and studied the print. He took a deep breath, opened his mouth to begin, and laughed, shaking his head, offering the newspaper to the German.
"I can't even fake it."
"Sorry." "Don't apologize. Shoulders like yours would be wasted at a desk. Good man, you'll be fine." Kolya nodded, smiling at the officer like a handsome idiot. He was supposed to join the group of illiterates, but he lingered next to me, his hands in his pockets.
"I want to see if my friend can do any better," he said.
"Well, he can't do any worse," said the Einsatzkommando with a smile of his own. He stepped in front of me and looked me over. "How old are you? 15? I nodded. I didn't know if it was safer to be 15 or 17. I lied on instinct. "Where were your grandparents from?"
"Moscow." "All 4 of them?"
"Yes." I was lying automatically now, not even thinking about the words before I said them. "My parents met there."
"You don't look Russian to me." If I had to guess, I'd say you were a Jew.
We call him that all the time, said Kolya, ruffling my hair and grinning.
Our little Jew makes him crazy. But look at that nose. If I didn't know his family, I'd swear he was a Yid.
There are Jews with small noses, said the German, and Gentiles with large ones. We can't be careless with our assumptions. I saw a Jewess in Warsaw a few months ago. Her hair was blonder than yours. He gestured at Kolya's bare head, smiled, and winked. And it wasn't dyed. You understand?
I do,
said Kolya, smiling back. Don't be too worried, the German told me. You're young still. We all had our awkward years. So tell me, are you any better than your friend here? I looked down at the newspaper in my hand.
I know this says Stalin, I pointed to the word. And, comrade?
Yes.
Well, that's a start.
He gave me an avuncular smile, patted my cheek, and took the paper. I thought he might have felt bad for saying I looked like a Jew.
Very good. You'll keep your friend here company in Estonia. A few months of hard work never hurt anyone. This will all be over soon.
And you, he added, moving down to Vika, the last in the line, another child. What do you have for me? Vika shrugged and shook her head, never looking up, offering the unread paper to the Einsatz commando.
Right. Another victory for the Bolshevik education system.
Good. All three of you to the left. We joined the group of grinning illiterates. One of them had worked in a steel mill before, and the others were gathered around him, listening to him describe the terrible heat and the danger in handling molten metal. Markov's betrayer stood just outside the circle, rubbing his bare hands to keep them warm, ignored by everyone.
Was that Abendroth?
I whispered to Vika. She shook her head.
Abendroth's rank is Sturmbannführer.
4 silver pips on the collar tabs. This one only had 3. The company translator was counting each group of prisoners, pointing at heads and moving his lips. When he was finished, he announced to the Einsatz commando,
57 readers, 38 non-readers.
Very good. The sun was down and the air was getting colder. The Einsatz commando walked over to the folding chair, where his overcoat waited, while the troopers formed the literate prisoners into 2 rows and ordered them to march. The Russians gave cheerful waves to their less educated comrades across the way. They marched with precision now, far different from our stumbling procession earlier in the day. Boots rose and fell on the beat, left right, left right. The prisoners wanted to impress their German masters, to prove they deserved this chance to serve out their time clipping newspapers in Viborg. The Einsatz commando wasn't watching them anymore. He buttoned his coat, slipped on his leather gloves, and headed off toward the parked Kubels. The literate prisoners marched to the windowless brick sidewall of the school building, where they halted and faced front. Even then they didn't understand what was happening to them. How could they? They were good students. They had passed the test and been rewarded. I looked at Vika, but she was staring off into the distance, refusing to watch. The German troopers leveled their submachine guns and fired at the line of Russians. They kept their fingers on the triggers until the magazines were empty, and the Russian men lay splayed and shredded on the ground, smoke rising from their singed coats. The Germans reloaded, walked over to the wall, and fired single shots into the heads of anyone still breathing. In front of the schoolhouse, I saw the Einsatz commando greet the young bareheaded soldier who had been filling the fuel tanks. Whatever the officer said must have been funny. The young soldier laughed and nodded in agreement. The Einsatz commando stepped into one of the cubicles and drove away. The young soldier picked up the empty jerry cans and lugged them toward the schoolhouse. Before he got very far, he paused and looked into the sky. I could hear it now, the purr of aeroplane engines above us. The silver Junkers flew west in pointed formations of 3 for the first bombing raid of the evening. 3 after 3 after 3, filling the sky like migrating birds. All of us, the surviving prisoners and the mountain rangers, stood in silence and watched the planes pass.
Chapter 21. We slept in a tool shed behind the schoolhouse, 35 of us jammed into a space 8 men might have slept in comfortably. No one could lie down flat. I sat folded into a corner with Kolya on one side of me and Vika on the other. This was bad for my back, but good for my breathing. The gaps between the wallboards provided the only ventilation, and if I got too claustrophobic, I could turn my head and suck clean, cold air. There was no light. The German troopers had nailed the shed door shut. We could hear the guards outside talking and lighting cigarettes, but the prisoners still talked of escape. I couldn't see their faces, and the effect was like listening to one of the radio plays my mother used to like.
I'm telling you, we could crack it open like a walnut shell. One man puts his shoulder into it, he'd bust right through the wall. You think so? You a carpenter? I am. When they shoved us in here, I got a look at the walls. That's silver birch. That's strong wood. And what happens to the man busting through the wall? The guards out there waiting with machine guns. How many? 2, 3? We rush them. They'll take a few of us, but we'll get them. Can anyone see how many are out there?
I dipped my head and peered through the gap.
I see only 2, but there might be more on the other side. Long as I don't go first, we'll all go together. There's still got to be a first man out and a last man out. I say we wait and do what they say. The war won't last forever. Who is that? Edik? Why don't you burn in hell, you old bitch? Didn't you see what happened out there today? You still trust these pig fuckers? If they wanted to shoot us, they would have shot us. It was only the fancy boys they wanted, the ones in the party. Ah, you're a miserable old bastard, you know that? I hope your children shit in your soup.
Kolya leaned across me so he could whisper to Vika in the darkness, out of earshot of the squabbling peasants.
That Einsatzkommando. He was right next to us. You told Markov we weren't going to shoot troopers. We were holding out for Einsatz. So?
For a long count, Vika did not respond, and I thought she must have been angered by the insinuation. But when she did speak, her tone was thoughtful.
Maybe I was afraid. And you?
Kolya sighed.
It didn't seem like the moment. Shoot one man and get blasted to pieces.
No, but maybe we waited too long. That might have been our best chance. I had known her for only a day, but Vika's comments surprised me. She did not seem the sort to admit doubt, and yet here she was, using the word maybe twice in a row.
I almost did it, said Kolya, nudging my shoulder. When he was asking you about your grandparents, I thought he might make you drop your pants, take a look at your meat. I had my hand on the butt of my gun. But we talked him out of it, didn't we? You like what I came up with?
You were good, I said.
Very quick. I think he wanted to fuck me, to be honest. He had that look.
What I said before about Jews, whispered Vika, touching my knee in the darkness. Just so you know, anyone the Nazis hate so much is a friend of mine.
He's only half a Jew, said Kolya.
He meant it as a compliment. The better half, I replied. Vika laughed. Until that moment, I hadn't known she was capable of laughter, and it was a strange sound, but not because there was anything odd about her laugh. She laughed like a normal girl.
What were you doing before the war? I asked her.
I was a student.
Said Kolya.
I was hoping he would fall asleep, but he sounded alert, ready for a long conversation.
So was I.
What did you study? Agriculture?
Why agriculture?
Aren't you from a collective?
Do I look like I'm from a fucking collective? I'm from Archangel. Ah, a northern girl. That explains everything.
He elbowed me in the side.
She really is Viking spawn. So you're in the university up there, studying wood sap and beavers.
Astronomy.
I'm a literature man myself. Leningrad State.
He rambled on about Shedrin and Turgenev and their flaws for a few minutes before abruptly falling asleep, his long legs stretched out in front of him, forcing me to keep my own legs doubled up against my chest. The peasants began to drop off too, though here and there I could still hear a whispered argument. The heat from all the huddled bodies kept the shed warm enough. Before they shoved us inside, I had managed to grab a few handfuls of snow to sip at in the darkness. I hadn't eaten anything since the trooper's cabin, where Kolya and I had shared a pocketful of walnuts we'd taken from the farmhouse, but a full day without food was nothing new. During the siege, all of us and Peter became hunger experts, with different techniques to distract us from our want. Back in my apartment in the Kirov, I had spent many famished nights studying Tarish's 300 chess games. Always put the rook behind the pawn, he instructed his students, except when it is incorrect to do so. Without a chess book to study, or a radio to listen to, I had to find another way to occupy my brain during the long wait for sleep. As the shed grew quieter, I became more and more aware of Vika's body pressed up against mine. When she shifted her head to take a gulp of air from the gap in the wallboards, her hair brushed against my nose. She smelled like a wet dog. I had been raised to be finicky. My mother never tolerated a dirty dish in the sink, an unfolded towel in the bathroom, or an unmade bed. When we were little, and she scrubbed us in the bathtub, her rough sponging left my skin raw. Sometimes, if my mother was getting dinner ready for a party, my father would bathe me, and it was like a reprieve from a whipping as he splashed warm water at me, distracted by whatever story he was telling. I loved The Tale of the Cross-Eyed Lefty from Tula and the Steel Flea, and he would give it to me from memory time and again. I was raised to be clean, and it bothered me when others were not, when the Antokolsky twins had dirt under their nails, or a teacher at school had a soup stain on his collar. But Vika's wet dog smell did not offend me. All of us were slathered in grime by that point, of course. I must have stunk like weak old fish myself. But this wasn't about being inured to foul odors. The tang off her body made me want to lick her clean. "Do you think they'll really take us to Estonia?" I asked her. Thinking about Vika had been a distraction from my hunger. Now I needed a distraction from my distraction. I was not sitting in a comfortable position to have the thoughts I was having. "I don't know. I've never been to Archangel. It must be very cold up there." In the silence of her non-answer, I considered the possibility that I was a very boring person. Who else but a boring person would utter such meaningless trifles? If a brilliant pig, the prodigy of the barnyard, spent his entire life learning Russian, and on finally becoming proficient, the first words he heard were my own, he would wonder why he had wasted his best years when he could have been lolling in the mud, eating slop with the other dumb beasts.
"You studied astronomy?"
"Yes."
"All right, so I have a question. There are billions of stars in the universe, right? We're surrounded by stars, and all of them emit light, and the light travels forever. So why..."
"Why isn't the sky bright at night?"
"Yes! You've thought about it, too."
"People have been thinking about it for a long time."
"Oh? I thought maybe I was the first."
"No," she said. And from the way she said it, I knew she was smiling.
"So, how come it's dark at night?"
"The universe is expanding."
"Really?"
"Hmm."
"No, I mean, I knew the universe was expanding."
I lied. How could the universe expand? Wasn't the universe everything? How does everything stretch out any farther?
What does it stretch into? I just don't see how that explains the starlight.
"It's complicated," she said. "Open your mouth."
"What?" "Shh. Open your mouth."
I did as I was told, and she slipped a crust of rye bread through my lips. Unlike the tooth-breaking loaves given out as rations in Peter, this tasted like real bread, like caraway seeds and yeast and scalded milk.
"Good?" "Yes."
Piece by piece, she fed me a full slice of the bread. When she was finished, I licked my lips and waited for more, even though I knew no more was coming.
"That's it. I have to save the rest for tomorrow. Your friend will be hungry." "Thank you."
She grunted in response and shifted her position, trying to get comfortable.
"His name is Kolya, just so you know. And I'm Lev."
She seemed to respond to only half the comments I made, and this wasn't one of them. I had hoped she would say, "I'm Vika," so I could reply,
"Yes, I know. Short for Victoria, is it?"
For some reason, I thought that would be a clever remark, even though every Vika is a Victoria. I listened to her breathing, trying to judge whether or not she had fallen asleep. I tested her by whispering one last question.
So if you were an astronomy student, I don't really understand. How did you become a sniper?
I started shooting people. That sounded like the end of the conversation to me, so I shut my mouth and let her sleep. Later in the night, I woke up when one of the old peasants on the other side of the shed had a coughing fit. Listening to him hacking up phlegm that had probably been inside his lungs since the reign of Alexander III, I realized that Vika had slipped against me in her sleep, her cheek resting on my shoulder. I could feel her chest rise and fall, the tick of the inhale, the tock of the exhale. For the rest of the night, I stayed as still as I possibly could, trying not to disturb her, trying very hard to keep her close. Chapter 22. The Germans woke us by prying the nails out of the planks they had hammered over the doorway. Sunlight shot through the gaps in the wallboard, tiny spotlights shining on a greasy forehead, a leather boot with a sole curling away from the toe, the horn buttons of an old man's coat. Vika sat next to me, chewing on her fingernails. She chewed methodically, not an anxious person with a nervous habit, but a butcher sharpening his knives. At some point in the night, she had moved away from me, and I hadn't felt her leave. She looked up when she sensed I was watching, and there was no trace of affection in her eyes. Any glimmer of intimacy I felt in the darkness was gone in the daylight. The door opened, the Germans shouted at us to move, and the peasants disentangled themselves from one another. I saw the old man, Edick, press a gnarled forefinger against one nostril and blow a gob of snot to the floor, barely missing another man's face.
Ah, grumbled Kolya, wrapping his scarf around his neck. Don't you wish you grew up with our comrade farmers on a collective?
As the prisoners began to file out the door, a man on the far side of the shed cried out. Those around him turned to see what had frightened him, and soon they were anxiously whispering among themselves. From our corner, all we could see were peasants' backs. Kolya and I stood, curious about the commotion. Vika, uninterested, headed for the door. We stepped to the other side of the shed, sidling around the muttering peasants, and looked down at the man still lying there. It was Markov's accuser, his throat slashed, the blood long drained from his body, and his face chalk white. He must have been murdered in his sleep, or we would have heard him cry out, but his eyes had popped open when the knife cut his skin. They bulged from their sockets, staring with horror at our downturned faces. One of the peasants yanked off the dead man's boots. A second took his sheepskin gloves. A third pulled the tooled leather belt from the belt loops on his pants. Kolya knelt down and snatched the quilted down cap before anyone else could. I turned and saw Vika adjusting her own rabbit fur cap, setting it very low on her forehead. She looked at me for a second and walked out of the tool shed. A moment later, a German trooper stepped inside, angry at the delay, ready to fire his weapon. He saw the corpse, the gaping throat, the bloodstain that started under the dead man's back and spread across the floorboards like a pair of monstrous black wings. The murder irritated the trooper. This required an explanation for the officers. He asked a question in German, more to himself than any of us, not expecting an answer. Kolya cleared his throat and replied. I couldn't judge Kolya's German, but the trooper seemed amazed to hear his own language spoken by a prisoner. The German shook his head, gave a curt response, and gestured with his thumb for us to leave the shed. When we were outside, I asked Kolya what he had said.
I told him the peasants hate the Jews even more than your people do.
And what did he say?
There is a proper way of doing things.
Very Germanic.
He was trying to fit his new cap onto his bare head. It wasn't really big enough, but he managed to yank the ear flaps down far enough so he could tie the drawstrings together.
You think it's smart to let them know you speak German, after what they did yesterday?
No, I think it's dangerous, but at least now they won't ask any more questions.
The prisoners had begun organizing into a single-file line. We shuffled forward, squinting in the bright morning sun, toward a hulking, hungover trooper, his eyes still crusted with sleep, who handed each of us a single round biscuit, hard and dry as a lump of coal.
A good sign, muttered Kolya, tapping at his biscuit with his fingernail.
Soon we were marching south, with the Gebersjäger company, heads bowed against the wind. Today we walked on the road, though the pavement was hidden beneath layers of tread-marked snow. A few kilometers away from the schoolhouse, we passed a sign from Ga, and I pointed it out to Kolya.
Huh? What is today?
I had to think about it, counting backward in my head to Saturday.
Wednesday. We're supposed to show up with the eggs tomorrow. Wednesday. I haven't shit in 13 days. 13 days. What happens to it all? It's not like I haven't eaten anything. Darling soup and some sausages? Those buttered potatoes with the girls? Ration bread? What's it doing? Just sitting in my belly, a fucking lump?
You want a shit? Asked Edith, the old bearded peasant, who had heard Kolya's complaints and now turned to give advice.
Boil some buckthorn bark and drink the water. Never fails. Wonderful. You see any buckthorns around here?
Edith glanced at the roadside pines and shook his head. I'll give a whistle if we pass any.
Many thanks. Maybe you can find me the boiling water, too.
Edik had already faced front and resumed his place in the line, mindful that one of the troopers had looked our way.
Stalin goes to visit one of the collectives outside of Moscow, began Kolya in his joke-telling voice. Wants to see how they're getting along with the latest 5-year plan. Tell me, comrade, he asks one farmer, how did the potatoes do this year? Very well, comrade Stalin. If we pile them up, they would reach God. But God does not exist, comrade farmer. Nor do the potatoes, comrade Stalin.
Old one.
Jokes only get old if they're good. Otherwise, who keeps telling them?
People like you, who aren't funny.
I can't help it if you never laugh. I make the girls laugh. That's what matters.
You think she did it? I asked him. He glanced at me, confused for a moment, until he saw I was watching Vika, who marched apart from us today, near the front of the procession.
Of course she did it.
She was squeezed up against me all night. When I fell asleep, her head was on my shoulder.
That's as close to sex as you've ever been. You see that? You've listened to me, and you've learned.
And somehow she managed to get away from me, and I'm a very light sleeper. Crawl around 30 peasants in total darkness, cut the man's throat, and come back, without waking a single person? Kolya nodded, still watching Vika, who walked alone, scanning the roadside and the position of the German troops.
She's a talented killer.
Especially for an astronomer.
Ha! Don't believe everything you hear.
You think she's lying?
I'm sure she went to university for a while. That's where they recruit. But come, little lion, you think she learned to shoot like that in astronomy class? She's NKVD. They have agents in every partisan cell.
You don't know that. He stopped for a few seconds to kick one boot against the other, knocking off snow trapped in the sole, holding my arm to balance himself.
I don't know anything. Maybe your name isn't Lev. Maybe you're the greatest lover in the history of Russia. But I consider the facts, and I make an educated guess. The partisans are local fighters. That's why they're so effective. They know the land better than the Germans ever will. They have friends in the area, family. People who can give them food, a safe place to sleep. Now tell me, how far are we from Archangel?
I don't know.
I don't know either. 700-800 kilometers? The German border is probably closer. You think the local partisans just decided to trust some girl who showed up out of nowhere? No. She was sent to them.
She plodded through the snow ahead, her hands jammed into the pockets of her coveralls. From behind, she looked like a 12-year-old boy wearing a stolen mechanic's uniform.
I wonder if she has any tits,
said Kolya. His crudity annoyed me, though I had wondered the same thing. Judging her body beneath the oversized coveralls was impossible, but from what I could tell, she was curveless and slender as a blade of grass. He noticed the expression on my face and smiled.
Did I offend you? I apologize. You really like this one, don't you? I don't know. I won't talk about her that way anymore. Will you forgive me?
You can talk about her any way you want.
No, no. I understand now. But listen,
This isn't an easy fish to hook.
Are you going to give me more advice from your made-up book?
Just listen. Make your jokes, fine. But I know more about these things than you. My guess is she was a little bit in love with that Korsakov, and he was a tougher man than you, so you can't impress her with toughness.
She wasn't in love with him.
Just a little bit.
I never thought I was going to impress her with toughness. Do you think I'm that stupid?
So the question is, what do you impress her with?
Here Kolya went silent for a long time, eyes scrunched up, forehead creased with worry lines as he pondered my assets. Before he could think of any, we heard shouts behind us and turned to see the troopers waving us to the side of the road. A convoy of Mercedes half-tracks with tarpaulin-covered flatbeds rumbled past, hauling provisions and materiel to the front lines. We stood watching for 5 minutes, and still there was no end to the slow-rolling convoy. The Germans could not have cared less about impressing their prisoners, but I was impressed. Fuel rationing in Peter meant that I rarely saw more than 4 or 5 moving vehicles in a day. I had already counted 40 of the hybrid trucks, with their rubber tires in front and tank tracks in the rear, their three-pointed stars on the grills, and white-bordered black crosses painted on the back sides. Behind the half-tracks came 8-wheeled armored cars, caterpillar-tracked heavy mortars, and light trucks carrying troopers seated on parallel benches, faces weary and unshaven, rifles strapped to their shoulders, huddled up in their white anoraks. We heard curses from the front of the convoy, drivers leaning out their windows to find out what the trouble was. One of the self-propelled artillery pieces had slipped a tread, and while its operators scurried to fix it, the howitzer blocked everything behind it. The infantrymen took the opportunity to jump out of their trucks and piss along the side of the road. Soon there was a line of several hundred troopers and half-track drivers and artillerymen, stamping their boots and hollering to their friends, leaning back to see who could launch their stream the farthest. Steam rose from the yellow snow.
"Look at these ass-lickers pissing on our land," muttered Kolya. "They won't be laughing so loud when I squat down to shit in the middle of Berlin."
The thought cheered him.
"Maybe that's why I can't squeeze one out. My bowels are waiting for victory."
Patriotic bowels.
Every part of me is patriotic. My cock whistles the Soviet hymn when it comes.
"Whenever I hear you two talking, it's always cocks and asses," said Vika. She had crept up behind us in her usual silent way, startling me when she spoke. "Why don't you both strip naked and get it over with?"
"It's not me he wants to strip naked,"
Kolya said with a leer. I felt a rush of anger and embarrassment, but Vika ignored the comment, keeping an eye out for watchful guards and other prisoners as she slipped us both half slices of her good rye bread. "You see the officers' cars at the end of the convoy?" she asked, looking in that direction but not raising a hand to point.
"That's the best bread I've had since summer,"
Kolya said, his portion already devoured. "You see the commandeur wagon with the swastika fender pendants? That's Abendroth's car." "How do you know?" I asked her.
"Because we've been tracking him for 3 months. I almost had a shot at him outside Budagosh. That's his car." "What's the plan?"
asked Kolya, picking at the caraway seed stuck between his teeth. "When the convoy starts moving again, I'll wait till he's close and I'll take my shot. Shouldn't be hard." I looked up and down the road. We stood in the middle of what seemed like a full battalion, surrounded by hundreds of rifle-toting Germans on foot and in armored vehicles. Vika's pronouncement meant that we would die in a few minutes, whether or not she hit her target.
"I'll take the shot," said Kolya. "You and Lev stand over there with those cretins from the collective. No point bringing us all down."
Vika curled her lips in her half-smile and shook her head. "I'm the better shooter."
"You've never seen me shoot."
"True. And I'm the better shooter." "It doesn't matter," I told them. "Both of you shoot. What difference does it make? You think they'll let any of us live after that?"
"The boy has a point," said Kolya.
He surveyed the illiterate prisoners standing around us, shuffling their feet and clapping their hands to keep warm, most of them farmers who had never before traveled more than a few kilometers from their collectives. A few Red Army privates were mixed into the lot. One or two of them, I was sure, could read just as well as I could.
How many prisoners did they say? 38? 37 now, said Vika. She saw me staring at her, and she stared right back with those pitiless blue eyes. How long do you think you'll last before one of these peasants notices you're missing a few bits down there? And here she pointed at my crotch, and turns you in for an extra bowl of soup.
37. Seems like too many to sacrifice for one German, said Kolya.
37 prisoners headed to the steel mills. These men aren't Russian assets anymore, she said in her quiet, uninflected tone. They're German labor, and Abendroth is worth sacrificing for. Kolya nodded, peering at the Kommandeurwagen in the distance.
We're pawns, and he's the rook. That's what you're saying.
We're less than pawns. Pawns have value.
If we can take a rook, we have value too.
Saying this, Kolya blinked and looked at me. He flashed a sudden and certain smile. His whole Cossack face lit up with the grandeur of a new idea.
Maybe there's another way. Wait here a minute. What are you doing?
Asked Vika, but it was too late. He had already started toward the closest cluster of troopers. The Germans narrowed their eyes when they saw him coming and moved their fingers toward their trigger guards. But Kolya held up his hands and began chattering to them in their native tongue, as cheerful and relaxed as if we were all gathered together to watch a parade. After 30 seconds they were laughing at whatever jokes he was telling. One of the troopers even let him take a long drag off the man's cigarette.
He has charm, said Vika. She sounded like an entomologist discussing a beetle's carapace. They probably think he's their long-lost Aryan brother.
The two of you are a strange couple.
We're not a couple. I don't mean it like that.
Don't worry, Lyova. I know you like girls.
My father had called me Lyova, and hearing the nickname coming from her mouth, so unexpected, but so natural, as if she had been calling me that for years, almost made me want to cry.
He made you angry before, didn't he, when he said that about wanting to see me naked?
He says a lot of stupid things.
So, you don't want to see me naked?
Vika wore her mocking smile now, standing with her feet wide apart, her hand jammed into the pockets of her coveralls.
I don't know.
Yes, it was a stupid and cowardly response, but I could not handle the morning's peaks and valleys. One moment I thought I had a few minutes left to live, the next a sniper from Archangel was flirting with me.
Was she flirting with me?
The days had become a confusion of catastrophes. What seemed impossible in the afternoon was blunt fact by the evening. German corpses fell from the sky. Cannibals sold sausage links made from ground human in the Haymarket. Apartment blocks collapsed to the ground. Dogs became bombs. Frozen soldiers became signposts. A partisan with half a face stood swaying in the snow, staring sad-eyed at his killers. I had no food in my belly, no fat on my bones, and no energy to reflect on this parade of atrocities. I just kept moving, hoping to find another half slice of bread for myself and a dozen eggs for the colonel's daughter.
He told me your father was a famous poet.
He wasn't that famous.
Is that what you want to be? A poet?
No, I don't have any talent for it.
What do you have talent for?
I don't know. Not everybody has talent.
That's true, despite what they always told us.
From the look of things, Kolya was delivering a grand lecture to the troopers arrayed around him in a semicircle, making elaborate hand gestures to punctuate his sentences. He pointed at me, and I felt my throat constrict as the German soldiers turned and glanced my way, curious and amused.
What the hell is he telling them?
Vika shrugged. He'll get himself shot if he's not careful. The troopers seemed doubtful, but Kolya kept cajoling them, and finally one of them, shaking his head as if he couldn't quite believe he was listening to this lunatic Russian, adjusted the strap of his MP-40 and hustled toward the back of the convoy. Kolya nodded to the remaining men gathered around him, made some final joke that had them grinning again, and ambled back to us.
The Nazis adore you, said Vika.
Were you quoting Mein Kampf?
Tried to read it once. Very dull.
What did you say to them?
I told them I had a wager for Herr Abendroth, that my friend here, A 15-year-old boy from the less fashionable side of Leningrad could play without a queen and still beat the Sturmbannführer in a game of chess. I'm 17. Oh, well. 15 is more of an insult.